The headline: Sudan's security forces fired tear gas at demonstrators the day after they killed 9 people protesting against the country's military rulers who seized power 8 months ago. Official data show inflation in the Eurozone countries reached a new record high in June after a sharp rise in energy and food prices. Also ahead, Moscow denies targeting civilians as Ukraine says Russian missile strikes left dozens of casualties in Odessa overnight. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story: in Sudan, people have taken to the streets of Khartoum for another day of protests against the country's military coup. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowds. Medics say another protester was beaten and killed due to injuries. This a day after 9 people were shot dead by security forces during massive demonstrations. The recent deaths bring the total number of protesters killed to 113 since the start of the coup 8 months ago. Demonstrators are demanding the return to civilian rule. Months-long unrest in Sudan led to the ouster of then-President Omar al-Bashir in 2019. A subsequent power-sharing deal struck between the military and civilians was scrapped in a coup in October 2021. For months, people in the Eurozone have been paying out more money on energy and basic needs. Now, official data show inflation in the country sharing the euro has jumped to another record high. The EU's Eurostat data agency says the consumer prices index reached 8.6% in June. That's up from the previous record of 8.1% a month earlier. The European Central Bank says it will do whatever it takes to tackle the surge in prices and bring inflation back to its target level. The ECB is due to convene later this month to announce its new interest rates. Experts say a hike in interest rates could plunge the Eurozone economy into recession. The war in Ukraine has driven up fuel costs, exacerbating the cost of living problems. And at least 19 people have been killed, 30 more wounded in missile strikes in Ukraine's southern Odessa region. Local officials blame Russia, saying the missiles were fired by aircraft flying in from the Black Sea. The officials say the strikes hit a 9-story apartment building and a nearby resort facility. Russia has denied striking the building. The attack comes a day after Russian forces left Snake Island off the coast of Odessa in the Black Sea. Ukraine said it had driven the Russians after an artillery and missile attack, with President Volodymyr Zelensky hailing the win. But Russia said the exit was an act of good gesture to show that it's not hampering grain shipments from Ukraine. To the east, Moscow keeps advancing in the Donbass region, where it's now trying to take control of the city of Lysychansk. Airport workers at the main international airport in Paris have gone on strike, demanding a pay raise big enough to cushion the blow of high inflation.
It's been 5 or 6 years that our salaries have not increased. With life after COVID, the rising gas prices, the prices of basic necessities that won't stop rising, we are asking for salaries to be increased, since even coming to work is becoming difficult.
Ground staff members held banners outside the airport to demand better pay, disrupting early summer travels in France. The strike forced the cancellation of about 10% of flights on Thursday. This amid booming demand for air travel, as well as staff shortages due in large part to the COVID-19 pandemic. Inside the airport, crowds of travelers filled the departure area. An airport worker said a strike is indeed bothering travelers, but there was no other choice.
What do we want? We want a pay raise now. Yes, we know that we're taking passengers hostage, but we need to make our voice heard, and the only way to do that is with a strike, blocking the airport. And if the airport is really blocked, it could work.
The government says authorities are holding exchanges with unions in hopes of finding a way out of the current circumstances. Rising living costs are hurting households in Europe. Several European airlines and airports have experienced strikes in recent weeks, and travel and more travel disruptions are expected next month. Soaring prices have also led to strikes or threats of industrial action by workers in schools, postal services, and hospitals, among other sectors. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls to suspend the deputy chief whip from the Conservative Party after the lawmaker embroiled the party in a new scandal. The Labour Party says Johnson has serious questions to answer about how Chris Pincher can remain a Tory MP. The lawmaker resigned after he reportedly groped two men. The main opposition party is doubtful about the Conservatives' ability to tackle the challenges facing the British people. The opposition says Conservatives are, quote, so mired in sleaze and scandal. Calls for Pincher's suspension have also been made by Conservative politicians like former ministers Caroline Noakes and Karen Bradley and several other Tories. Pincher's episode has been the latest scandal to plague Johnson and his administration in recent months. Well, Hong Kong's new leader has been sworn in, replacing the city's first female chief executive, Carrie Lam. Chinese President Xi Jinping attended the inauguration ceremony, which was held on the 25th anniversary of Hong Kong's handover from Britain to China. Xi hailed the handover and defended Beijing's policy on Hong Kong. We've discussed that in depth during our news review program.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the Chinese president addresses a ceremony in Hong Kong that marks the 25th anniversary of the city's handover from Britain to China. Xi Jinping says there is no reason to change Beijing's one country, two systems policy.
Today, I wish to highlight once again that the policy of one country, two systems, having been tested and proved time and again, meet the fundamental interests of the country and the Chinese nation, and those of Hong Kong and Macau. It enjoys the full support of more than 1.4 billion people of the motherland. It has the unanimous endorsement of Hong Kong and Macau residents, and it is widely recognized by the international community. There's no reason to change such a good system, and it must be adhered to over the long run.
She said Hong Kong's true democracy began after it joined mainland China. He also said everything the central government does is for the good of Hong Kong. He referred to a security law passed last year in the financial hub. President Xi said the legislation is beneficial for Hong Kongers' democratic rights and aims to ensure the city's stability. During the ceremony, Hong Kong's new chief executive, John Lee, was sworn in. He is a former security chief and replaces Carrie Lam. To discuss that further, we're joined by Andrew Leung, independent China specialist, who is joining us live from Hong Kong, and Zamir Ahmad Awan, a non-resident fellow at the Center for China and Globalization, joining us live from Islamabad. Thank you very much to both of you. Gentlemen, let's begin with Mr. Leung. Tell us about the significance of President Xi's visit to Hong Kong and his speech, especially this particular instance where he says that China will stick to the one country, two systems style of governance. What is the message in that?
Well, first of all, this is President Xi's first visit outside mainland China since the pandemic a couple of years ago. And then he even attended national meetings by Zoom. But this time he has chosen to visit Hong Kong personally, even when the pandemic in Hong Kong still have lingering risks. So this shows how much importance he attaches to the one country, two systems formula. As he said in his speech, the one country, two system formula has proved to be high and is unique, but it's been highly successful because it is governed by Hong Kong's common law, dates back to 150 years. And this is nowhere else in the world has such an arrangement. And of course, it's right at the heart of China's economic development and trajectory.
Okay, before we continue this discussion, let's take a look at some social media reactions to this story. Okay, so we have Carr Fransman says the speech was a positive sign. Hong Kong will operate on a separate system, providing a portal for mainland China to enter the world system. Xi Jinping says China's sovereignty over Hong Kong allows a high degree of autonomy as he hails one country, two systems. Matthew Brooker says what makes Xi think that he can speak for what Hong Kong people want. The Hong Kong people have already told him what they want, loudly and clearly, democracy. So, Mr. Awan, there have been messages from Western leaders. The U.S. Secretary of State has accused Beijing of eroding Hong Kong's autonomy and democracy. while Boris Johnson said Britain will not give up on Hong Kong and will hold China to its commitments. On the opposite side, there's Xi, who says the city's experienced democracy only after its return to China. We also heard Mr. Leung right now confirm that. You also mentioned that in your comments. What is your assessment, basically?
It is very good to talk. The British has ruled Hong Kong for more than a century, and through the appointed Governor General by the Queen of the UK, there was no election, there was no democracy at all. It was the only and only when the China took over Hong Kong in 1997, they hold the election, they have given the right to the people of Hong Kong to choose or elect the person of their own choice to rule their country or the Hong Kong region. I mean, it was very good to laugh when the British say eroding, or the Secretary of State says eroding the democracy. There was no democracy at all. I was very lucky that I was in China for 7 years during the 1980s, and I was the witness of the negotiation between the British government and the Chinese government. I was following the Hong Kong issue since beginning, and I have visited Hong Kong in both eras, and I can see visible change and improvement in Hong Kong.
Thank you very much, Mr. Samir Ahmed Awan, a non-resident fellow at the Center for China and Globalization, joining us live from Islamabad. Also, Mr. Andrew Leung, independent China specialist, joining us live from Hong Kong. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review.
Elsewhere, British football team Tottenham Hotspur's football club have come under fire after announcing a pre-season tour of Israel. Supporters and human rights activists have voiced concern that the club is sports washing an apartheid regime amid ongoing suffering of the Palestinian people. Robert Carter brings us the latest from Tottenham's home in London.
British Premier League football team Tottenham Hotspurs have come under fire ahead of a pre-season friendly match. The fixture, pitting Tottenham against Italian side AS Roma, scheduled in Haifa on July the 30th, has been condemned as an attempt to normalise crimes against Palestinians by critics.
The fans especially, amongst whom are many people of Muslim background or of ethnic minorities, they will be big supporters of the Palestinians, but the team going out there is a slap in the face for them.
The London-based Human Rights Commission launched a letter campaign encouraging supporters to write to Tottenham and demand the club cancel the controversial fixture. Elsewhere, pro-Palestine supporters condemned the fixture online.
We have an epidemic of Russophobia in this country and across the whole of the West, but there is no similar attempt to hold Israel to account for its crimes. 74 years since Israel was created out of the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, people who are still refugees with no home to go to.
Israel has been recognised by Amnesty International as an apartheid regime. Their crimes have been well documented for many years. Just days prior to Tottenham announcing the fixture, international outrage was sparked over the slaying of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhile.
Tottenham have so far not commented on any of the criticism, but they did announce last May that they were delighted with their planned tour of Israel. This suggests that perhaps Tottenham Hotspurs is not as concerned about human rights abuses as perhaps they should be. Robert Carter, London.
And hundreds of thousands of Muslims from all corners of the world have congregated in the city of Mecca to visit the Holy Kaaba. The first step to begin their pilgrimage is a particular state of purification and sanctity known as Ihram. Mahdi Abbasian has a report from Mecca.
As hundreds of thousands of Muslims embark upon a pilgrimage to the Holy Kaaba in Mecca, they must enter a particular state of purification and sanctity known as the Ihram. In Arabic, Ihram means prohibition and a state of holiness.
Ihram and Miqat are like a runway for planes. If one wants to ascend, he'd better use this runway. You can't do it from anywhere else.
Ihram is an obligatory prerequisite to Hajj. Muslims stop at a designated station to perform the rituals associated with wearing ihram. The stations of Miqat are the five prescribed places for ihram, located at different directional corners from the holy city of Mecca, Saudi Arabia. Pilgrims perform ablution and cleanse their bodies. Then they wear ihram and make niyat, the intention of performing hajj. Men are required to wear two pieces of white cloth that are unadorned and plain. Women are not required to conform to a specific dress code, but have to dress modestly. It is crucial to ensure that the clothes are neat and tidy.
In addition to its facade, Hajj has an essence. We must find out the essence of the act of wearing ihram. This attire signifies the removal of any impurity or unclean aspect from our body and soul.
We wear ihram to abstain from sins we have committed in the past and get closer to God. After wearing ihram, Muslims are prohibited from a number of acts.
Ihram also resembles the shroud used to wrap dead bodies before they are buried. Therefore, it's a reminder of how death comes unannounced and does not discriminate between anyone.
There are different stages in Hajj that are like wake-up calls for us in our lives. Ihram reminds us of the afterlife and that our existence would not perish after death.
After cleansing their bodies and wearing ihram, Muslims get ready for the journey to the holy city of Mecca and they will visit Kaaba. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The shot came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of farmers, working students who had gathered in the crowd. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Constant Mahout, Catherine Porter, Salam Gebrekidan, and Matt Apuzzo. The piece is titled, A Haitian President Tried to Hold France to Account for Its Years of Exploitation. He soon found himself ousted from power. The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of the farmers, workers and students who had gathered in the crowd. The French ambassador to Haiti, sitting on stage, hid his alarm behind an awkward smile. He knew Mr. Aristide well enough to expect barbs at Haiti's former French colonizers and slave masters. But on that day, on 7th of April 2003, the president suddenly started calling for reparations, a bombshell that became a hallmark of his presidency, and diplomats now concede part of his undoing. We had to try to defuse it, the French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goudoul, said of Mr. Aristide's call for reparations, calling it an explosive. With his remarks, Jean-Bertrand Aristide tried to excavate a history that remains all but buried in France. Long after Haitians threw off their shackles, beat Napoleon's forces and won their independence 2 centuries ago, France came back with warships and an unheard-of demand. that the people of Haiti pay astounding amounts of money to their former slave masters or face war again. Haiti became the first and only nation in the world to pay reparations to its former slave masters and their descendants for generations. According to a New York Times analysis of thousands of pages of archival documents, it shipped the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars to France, setting off a cycle of perpetual debt that sapped Haiti's ability to build a nation for more than 100 years. Yet, to this day, that history is not taught in French schools, and many of the country's most prominent aristocratic families are unaware that their ancestors kept collecting payments from Haiti's poorest people long after the end of slavery in Haiti. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president after decades of dictatorship, wanted France to do far more than acknowledge its past. He wanted restitutions from Paris. What beautiful schools, universities and hospitals we'll be able to build for our children, he told the crowd. How much food we will have in abundance. The consequences were immediate and lasting. In interviews, a dozen French and Haitian political figures recounted how a worried France worked quickly and doggedly to stifle Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for reparations before siding with his opponents and collaborating with the United States to remove Aristide from power. France and the United States have long said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for restitution had nothing to do with his ouster, that he had taken an autocratic turn, lost control of the country, and was spirited into exile to prevent Haiti, already heaving with turmoil, from careening into chaos. But France's ambassador to Haiti at the time, Thierry Burkhard, conceded in an interview that France and the United States had effectively orchestrated a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that his abrupt removal from power was probably a bit about his call for reparations from France as well. It made our job easier to dismiss the reparations claim without Jean-Bertrand Aristide in office, Thierry Burkhard noted. The showdown underscores how, 2 centuries after France forced the Haitians to pay their former slave masters for the liberty they had already won in battle, the effects continue to ripple through the politics of both countries. By calling for restitution, Haiti, a nation born from what historians called the world's most successful slave rebellion, struck at France's national identity as a beacon of human rights and threatened to inspire other nations with historical grievances against France to follow its lead. Nations in the Caribbean and in Africa. "We were very disdainful of Haiti," the French ambassador Yves Godwell recalled. "What I think we will never forgive Haiti for, deep down, is that it is the country that beat us." Even after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's removal of power in 2004, the calls for restitution have continued to reverberate, leading to a stunning concession more than a decade later by François Hollande, France's former president, who referred to the money Haiti was forced to hand over as ransom of independence. Since then, scholars have increasingly explored the history of Haiti's payments. Just this past December, at a conference on the grounds of the French Finance Ministry, one of the most prominent French historians on relations between the two countries, Jean-François Brière, called the payments a form of meta-slavery that prevented Haiti from breaking free of France long after independence. "All French people are affected by the nation's past in Haiti," said Jean-Marc Ayrault, a former French prime minister. Yet, Ayrault said, "French students don't learn about it and few officials discuss it. It's never taught in France, he said. It's never explained. Mr. Yves Goodwill, France's former ambassador to Haiti, wanted to negotiate. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's sudden call for restitution was a political hand grenade, he feared, threatening to embarrass France on the world stage and rip apart relations between the two countries. Yet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's stance was not unreasonable, he recalled thinking. He wasn't wrong to say how much harm it had done to his country, Mr. Goodwill said of France's history in Haiti, and to ask France for compensation in turn. The former French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goodwill, said he urged the French government at the time to open discussions with Haiti to help defuse the situation, but was firmly rejected. I didn't understand how we could be so stupid, Mr. Goodwill said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a polarizing figure who rose to office as a champion of the poor, knew his campaign was contentious and had timed it for maximal impact. He announced his demand on the 200th anniversary of the death of Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary leader seized by Napoleon Bonaparte's forces and carted off to prison in France, where he died without a trial. Why, after 200 years, is Haiti this impoverished? Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in a recent interview at his home in a suburb of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the reasons, he said, was the enormous amount of money that Haiti has been forced to hand over to France for generations, a heavy burden often called the independence debt. Mr. Aristide uncovered this history only after he had already been ousted from office the first time, his aide said, when a military coup d'etat deposed him in 1991 and forced him into exile in the United States. He began immersing himself in the growing scholarship on a history that even as Haiti's president, he knew little about. After the Americans helped restore him to power, he was re-elected in 2000 and intensified his research into Haiti's past. He would call many times, asking for more information, recalled Dr. Francis Saint-Hubert, a Haitian physician who had studied the links between the abysmal state of public health in Haiti and the money siphoned off by France. On the bicentennial anniversary, Jean-Bertrand Aristide upped the political ante by declaring the precise amount he said France owed Haiti. $21,685,135,571. French diplomats and some Haitians mocked the multi-billion-dollar figure as a misguided publicity stunt by a demagogue trying to maintain his grip on power. A group of 130 Haitian intellectuals denounced the restitution campaign as a desperate attempt to distract attention from the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government's totalitarian drift, incompetence and corruption. A French foreign ministry spokesman said France did not need to take lessons from Haiti's leaders. But a New York Times analysis of the long-term damage done by sending enormous sums of money to France shows that Haiti's losses may have been surprisingly close to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's figure of $21.68 billion. In fact, his estimate may have been a bit modest. The New York Times scoured thousands of pages of archival government documents to determine how much Haiti sent to France over the course of generations, not just in official payments to former slaveholders, but also for a loan to help pay them. The New York Times found that Haiti paid France a total of $560 million in today's dollars. But that only begins to account for the loss. With the help of 15 leading economies from around the world, we modelled what might have happened if that money had gone into the Haitian economy, rather than being siphoned off to France without getting any goods or any services in return. The New York Times' estimates found that over time, the payments to France cost Haiti from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth. Put in perspective, that is anywhere from 1 to 8 times the size of Haiti's entire economy in 2020. We were building a path to the truth, Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in the interview, without being told the outcome of the New York Times' analysis.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Inshallah, what I'd like to do in today's speech is to mention a few points that we can take from the history around Imam Jawad alayhi salam and how he became the Imam, and some of the uniqueness about the Imam alayhi salam. One time the Imam alayhi salam was traveling, and on the outskirts of the city, he came across this one lady who was crying. And next to her, there was a farm animal, like a cow, that it was dead. And he goes to her and he says that, my dear lady, why is it that you're crying like this? She says that this animal of mine was my source of my entire livelihood. Everything I was getting from was from this cow. And now it's died. What am I going to do? So Imam Jawad alayhi salam says that, would you like to see the cow be revived? And she says that that would be great. And he begins to make dua. And sure enough, soon afterwards, the cow comes back to life. She's very happy. And she asks him, she says that, tell me something. Are you Sayyidina Maryam? Are you Jesus? Because, you know, she had some knowledge that in history, the one who was famous for bringing the dead to life was Nabi Isa alayhi salam. And he says that, no, I'm just a servant of Allah. But I am from the family of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. That's one example. There's another example where there was one of the scholars of the time who came to the Imam alayhi salam, and the Imam could tell that he was a bit uncomfortable, he was a bit hesitant. So he says that, before you ask me your question, I'm going to tell you what you're here for. I know what you're here for. You're confused. You're in a state of doubt as to how is it that Allah could make somebody who is so young the Imam. Isn't that right? He says that, yes, that's correct. So the Imam says that, well, what would you like me to do? So that individual, he says that, can you show me a miracle? I want to see something that will convince me. So the Imam says that, sure. And soon afterwards, we have this in a hadith that the Imam's asa, his walking stick, that came to, it was able to speak. And it bears testimony to the imamah of the Imam. He said that, it says that, إِنَّهُ مَوْلَايَ إِمَامُ هَذَا الزَّمَانِ وَهُوَ الْحُجَّةِ. He is the Imam of the time, and he is the Hujjah. And that's something that convinces that man. And we have other examples of these miracles. But brothers and sisters, what's very interesting is that there were many times where the Imam alayhi salam was able to convince, and people were clear that he was the Imam, not on the basis of miracles. not on the basis of cows coming to life and sticks talking, but rather because they were able to see that this individual was somebody who was guided by Allah. There was one majlis that took place when he was 10 years old, where they say that he was asked 30,000 questions in that majlis, one after the other, and he was just answering them again, you know, one after the other. I don't know how, you know, you look at that number and you're wondering, how can that even be reasonable? How can you fathom that? But he was able to do that. And many other cases where they would ask him things, questions, difficult things from the Quran, from fiqh, from this thing and that thing, and the Imam alayhi salam was able to guide them. And all the doubts that they might have had, they became dispelled. It's a very beautiful hadith that we have from the father of Imam Muhammad Jawad alayhi salam, Imam Ar-Ridad. One time, there was a companion who came to him, and he asked him, he says that, tell me, why is it that different prophets were given different miracles? You know this, right? I'm sure you've come across this tradition before. Why is it that, for example, Nabi Musa alayhi salam was given the staff and then the hand? Why is it that Nabi Isa was given this miracle and that miracle? Imam Ridha alayhi salam explains that in the time of Nabi Musa alayhi salam, the prevailing science and the prevailing sort of art was sorcery and, you know, magic. And so Nabi Musa alayhi salam was given something that would totally dominate and obliterate whatever was being, you know, respected at that time. It would be very clear to the experts that this is something that cannot be man-made. This is something from God. And that's the way Nabi Musa was successful. At the time of Nabi Isa alayhi salam, there was a lot of interest in medicine and treating people and healing people. Nabi Isa alayhi salam was given something that none other at that time was given. And it was very clear when he performed his acts that he was sent by God. During the time of our Prophet, Imam Ridha alayhi salam explains, that the prevailing, you know, discipline at that time was the language and rhetoric. And Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi was given something, the Quran, that was so eloquent that anybody at that time, you know, was clearly aware that this is something from none other than God. Now, this is, brothers and sisters, this next part is very interesting and very important. The companion, Ibn Sakit, who asked Imam Ridha this question, he says, so tell me, what is it that you have been given? Now, of course, the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they were those who were explaining the Quran to the people, so they also had the Quran. Of course, they had access to the miracles of the other prophets as well. But what does he tell Ibn Sakit? He says that we have been given something which is the source of our, you know, domination and our superiority over others. What is that thing? We have been given the aql. We have been given the intellect, the rational faculty. Our aql is such that those who want to will be able to recognize the truth of the truthful ones. And those who want to can recognize the falsehood of the false ones. Brothers and sisters, if we connect this now to this question, why was the imam given the imamah at such a young age? There's a very important point here, that Allah wanted to show people that whatever system they had at that time of understanding what is more superior than the other, what is more respectable than the other, Allah wanted to come and completely knock that system down. It's not based on your tribe. It's not based on your seniority. It's not based on the number of years you've spent studying in different learning circles. It's not dependent on your wealth. No. What matters is the liyaqah, that aptitude, that honor and dignity that you have. And here, Allah chose to give that honor in the form of that aql and that ilm and that knowledge to somebody who was 7 years old. And this is a very important point. Allah doesn't look at our man-made systems and say that, okay, well, because we put value on that, therefore it has value. No, Allah gives us the system. He says, if you want to know the truth, you go and find it from me. Use your aql to understand that you are not capable of doing it. This is something very important. In today's world, we have these values which are being attacked. For example, you know, one of the values is that of modesty. Modesty is something which, you know, you go to typical modern society in the West or in the East, right, modesty is not something that people put a lot of value on. Right? Modesty of speech, modesty of conduct, modesty of interaction, modesty of dress, these are not things that people talk about. You're not going to find, you know, like high-profile workshops where they teach you about like modesty. No, they'll teach you about things which will give you a lot of wealth fast. They'll give you a lot of popularity. You can become a, you know, a social media influencer fast, right? These types of things. They don't talk about something like modesty. It's been a value that's deprecated. It's no longer important anymore. And sometimes, if we're not careful, you know, we come and we say that, well, what's value? We say that, okay, well, what's valuable and what's important is whatever the predominant society is saying. And this then can be something which goes very much in conflict with our ideology. What we learn from these type of examples is that the values come from Allah. At that time, you know, it was something new, right? It was a new thing. People were like, how can it be the case that after, you know, the Prophet becoming the Prophet at 40 years old, and then Amir al-Mu'mineen al-Islam at his age, and all the way that suddenly now we're going to have a leader who is only 7 years old? Yes, indeed. When Allah wants to, then that's what it's going to be.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Climate change is to blame for the majority of the heat waves being recorded around the planet, but the relation to other extreme events and their impacts on society is less clear, according to a new study. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Sophia Quaglia. The piece is titled Climate Change Role Clear in Many Extreme Events, but Social Factors Also Key, study finds. Climate change is to blame for the majority of heat waves being recorded around the planet, but the relation to other extreme events and their impacts on society is less clear, according to a new study. I think on the one hand, we overestimate climate change because it's now quite common that every time an extreme event happens, there is a big assumption that climate change is playing a big role, which is not always the case, said Friedrich Otto, a climate change and environment professor at the Grantham Institute at Imperial College, University of London, who was one of the lead authors of the new research. But on the other hand, we really underestimate those events where climate change does play a role in what the costs are, especially the non-economic costs of extreme weather events to our societies. In the study published in the journal Environmental Research Climate from IOP Publishing, Professor Otto's team used attribution science to pore over available international data, literature and climate models, as well as the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, and calculate how human-induced climate change is affecting the impact of five types of extreme weather events: heat waves, heavy rainfall, drought, wildfires, and tropical cyclones. They say that in the case of heat waves, the role of climate change is unequivocal, and that the average and extreme heat levels in every continent across the globe are increasing specifically because of human-caused climate change. A heat wave, with a 1 in 50 chance of happening in pre-industrial times, is now almost five times more likely to happen and will be 1.2 degrees Celsius hotter, according to an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. In the past 20 years, there have been 157,000 deaths from 34 heat waves, according to data from the MDAT disaster database. Yet the impact of human-induced climate change on heat waves and the repercussions are still largely underestimated. One big reason why we underestimate heat waves so dramatically is because no one's dropping dead on the street during a heat wave, or at least very few people do, Professor Friedrich Otto said. Most people died from pre-existing conditions suddenly becoming acute, Professor Otto added, and this often did not show up in data. Wildfires were also one of the big climate impacts not talked about enough, Professor Otto added. For other events such as droughts, floods, and tropical cyclones, there is a more nuanced link to climate change. For example, there are some regions of the world where droughts are becoming worse because of human-caused climate change, such as southern Africa, Professor Otto notes, while in other droughts, the climate change signal is either not there or very small. By focusing too much on climate change, it really takes the responsibility, but also the agency, away to address these local drivers of disasters, such as high poverty rates, missing infrastructure, investment, missing healthcare system, all these aspects of exposure and vulnerability that make every drought a catastrophe, Professor Otto said. That will not go away even if we stop burning fossil fuels today. I think that that is why the overestimation of climate change, by basically blaming this all on climate change, is not very helpful for actually dealing with and for actually improving resilience to these threats. Much of the problem in figuring out exactly to what extent climate change was responsible for the impact of extreme weather events, Professor Otto said, lay in the lack of reliable data around the globe. There is not enough information coming from lower and middle-income countries, although these are the places more likely to be at risk of the repercussions of human-induced climate change. Already, there's been substantial scientific progress in the last few years in attributing extreme weather events and their consequences to human-made climate change, said Francis Moore, a professor of environmental economics at the University of California, Davis, who was not involved in the new study. Professor Francis Moore added, "But an important caveat is that the consequences of climate change do not only operate through extremes. Changes in average conditions can also have large consequences for mortality, agriculture, worker productivity and safety. It may well be that the aggregate consequences of these changing non-extreme conditions constitute a large fraction of total climate change impacts. Professor Friedrich Otto called for a broader definition of what was considered as risk in climate change modelling, rather than simply sticking to hazards and impact. Other factors, such as the effects that extreme weather has on individuals, on labour productivity, on infrastructure, agriculture systems and property, should also be taken into account, he said. We started at no one was ever talking about climate change, and now we've sort of moved over to blaming a lot of things on climate change, Professor Otto said. This is a plea towards realizing that that reality is somewhat messy, in the middle, and that we need to disentangle these drivers better in order to actually prioritize our adaptation and resilience building to really address climate change properly.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Utilsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with the concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Imam brought the people to the arena, showed them the way, kept them in the arena and steered them away from despair and hopelessness. As for his school of thought, principles and goals, if we wish to briefly explain the foundation of Imam's school of thought and revolution, We must say that the foundation for all his activities was rising up for the cause of God. The goal was to rise for the cause of God. This is what he wrote in his youth at the office of the late Waziri Yazdi, God's greetings be upon him. Say, O Prophet, I advise you to do only one thing, rise up for the sake of God, individually or in pairs. This is Quran chapter 34, verse 46.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This uprising for the cause of God is firmly rooted in the Quran. This has been mentioned in this ayah of Surah Saba, or in the ayah which says, and stand in true devotion to God, chapter 2, verse 238, which is in Holy Surah Al-Baqarah. Another ayah is in Surah Al-Mudathir, which was sent down in the beginning of Ba'tha. O you covered up in your cloak, arise and warn all, chapter 74, verses 1 and 2. This is what rising for the cause of God means. Of course, rising for the cause of God might occur in different ways in every era. Rising for the cause of God does not always take on a single form, but there is only one goal behind it, and that is the establishment of the truth, the administration of justice, and the promotion of spirituality. This holds true at all times. This means the establishment of the truth. Rising for the cause of God might take place in the form of military fight at one time and at another time. It might take on a significant form, and at yet another time it might take on a political form. But the purpose of rising for the cause of God must establish the truth.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.